This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
In Gambia, the National Assembly has extended President Yahya Jammeh's term by 3 months on a newly declared state of emergency.
That's Katerina Hoye reporting from Banjul. We'll have the latest from the Gambia coming up. Also, more than 50 people are dead and more than 100 others injured today when a vehicle packed with explosives blew up at a military camp in northern Mali. Emergency medical supplies are being flown to Ran in Borno State in northeastern Nigeria after a military airstrike yesterday killed more than 50 people. And a new report says it'll take hundreds of years to end extreme child poverty if the current pace of humanitarian efforts continues. We'll have these stories and more. Stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. More than 50 people are dead and more than 100 others injured today when a vehicle packed with explosives blew up at a military camp in northern Mali. The Associated Press reports the dead and wounded include soldiers and former Tuareg rebels trying to stabilize the region. No one has claimed responsibility yet, but authorities suspect extremist groups in the region. AP says the explosion targeted the Joint Operational Mechanism base in the northern city of Gao. Malian soldiers live there along with former fighters who had signed a peace deal with the government in 2015. They're training to launch joint patrols in the region. The death toll may rise because many of the wounded are in serious condition. The attack occurred around 9 a.m. local time, just as hundreds of fighters had gathered for a meeting. Mali is also a dangerous place for UN peacekeepers. Nearly 30 were killed last year in attacks by jihadist groups. Human Rights Watch says those groups are trying to impose strict Sharia law and are pressuring families to give up their children so they can become child soldiers. Emergency medical supplies are being flown to Ran in Borno State in northeastern Nigeria after a military airstrike yesterday killed more than 50 people and wounded well over 100. Reports say local medical facilities have been overwhelmed by casualties. Many are being taken to Maiduguri, the Borno State capital. The airstrike was meant for Boko Haram militants that reportedly were in the area. The government says an investigation will be done into how and why the airstrike hit the wrong location. The president is sending a delegation to Ran. The UN says Ran is a locality that recently became accessible to humanitarian agencies. The area previously had been under Boko Haram control. Bad roads also contributed to the lack of access. About 43,000 people are displaced there and face serious food shortages and severe acute malnutrition. The medical aid group Doctors Without Borders calls the incident shocking and unacceptable. Human Rights Watch says the Nigerian government should compensate the victims. It says even if the camp was not intentionally targeted, the camp was bombed indiscriminately, which violates international law. AFP reports 6 Nigerian Red Cross workers were among those killed in the strike. In the Gambia, the National Assembly has extended President Yahya Jammeh's term by 3 months under a newly declared state of emergency. Katerina Hoye has the latest from the capital, Banjul.
The central market in Banjul was deserted Wednesday amid a heavy police presence throughout the downtown area. The harbor where people board a ferry to take them out of the capital and onto Senegal was packed. Port authorities said thousands left yesterday, and a steady stream of women and children were headed in that direction today with their luggage. The uncertainty centers around Thursday, January the 19th, the day that President-elect Adama Barrow is scheduled to be inaugurated. In Banjul, people are growing impatient with Yahya Jammeh.
He's wrong. As far as you sit for 22 years, you should give other people a chance.
But Jammeh is digging in. He has condemned what he has called extraordinary foreign interference in the country's affairs. He challenged the election results, but the Supreme Court says it is unable to meet until May because of a shortage of judges. ECOWAS says Yemen must step down Thursday. The regional bloc is threatening a military intervention. International tour groups are scrambling to evacuate tourists. Tom Laker, a Dutch citizen, was preparing to head to the airport.
Well, I don't actually think that tourists here are in danger, but I do see that the situation is tense enough to maybe warrant bringing people back home.
In a televised statement, Yemen said that the security forces have been instructed to maintain law and order and that acts intended to disturb public order and peace are banned. The airport remains open. President-elect Barrow is in the Senegalese capital, Dakar. He needs to be inaugurated on Gambian soil. Barrow has insisted that will happen Thursday as scheduled, though from the looks of things here in Banjul, it does not look like it will take place here. Katrina Heye for VOA News, Banjul.
A new report says it'll take hundreds of years to end extreme child poverty if the current pace of humanitarian efforts continues. The aid organization Save the Children says if things don't improve soon, extreme child poverty may not be eliminated until the year 2482. The UN Sustainable Development Goals had set a target date of 2030. The message is being delivered to leaders attending the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. Carolyn Miles is president and CEO of Save the Children. From Fairfield, Connecticut, she spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua.
A recent report that we did says that we're about 450 years away from delivering on this promise of ending extreme child poverty. So that is obviously way off the 2030 target dates. And, you know, there is a huge amount that still has to be done. And a big focus needs to be on the places where we have the highest rates of child poverty, which are Southeast Asia and Sub-Saharan Africa. Those are where the most kids live in poverty. But I also think this is relevant to developed countries as well. You know, we have a big child poverty issue here, even in the United States, in many, many states here in the U.S.
Now, some of our listeners, or many of our listeners, may be wondering how you got to the 450-year mark.
Yeah. So we just looked at basically where we were now and how long if we kept going at the same pace in terms of changing the rates of child poverty, and that's child living on less than $1.90 a day. That's the definition. So we just looked at if we were going at the same rate of decreasing child poverty, how long would it take us to get there, to get to no child living in child poverty, and that's how we came up with that 400, and actually it's 452 years that it would take us. So obviously, things need to be done differently. There's lots of good things that are happening. There's the use of technology that's really helping us reduce child poverty, get kids into school, keep them in school, make sure that they're learning. That's one of the key things that changes this statistic. But we've got to do much more and much more quickly if we're really going to get there by 2030.
Like what?
Education, as I said, is one of the biggest issues. But the other thing is really focusing, as I said, where kids are living in poverty and making sure that things like international aid goes to those places where you've got the most kids living in extreme poverty. So that's one thing. Second thing is you see a huge increase in poverty rates when you have war and conflict. A good example is, you know, the Middle East and the number of children now living in poverty in that region, which used to be actually, compared to other places in the world, much lower. And because kids are living as refugees and they're living outside of their homes, that rate goes way, way up. So those are two things that we can do.
Give me some of the consequences of children living in extreme poverty.
The cycle of poverty is the biggest impact. So poor kids who grow up to be poor young people who never break out of that cycle are much more likely to have children who are themselves living in poverty. So it's that cycle of the next generation. You know, it doesn't sound like a lot of money, right? $1.90 a day, if we can get people to like $3 a day, a lot of people would say that just doesn't seem like much money. But breaking that cycle where you're not living in this grinding poverty with no opportunities to advance, that does change things.
You say there are even physical effects from extreme poverty.
Absolutely. I mean, poor children are much more likely to be malnourished. That affects both physical growth, but it also affects mental growth. We know from the work that we do around the world that kids who are malnourished are not going to be able to learn as well. Brain development happens quite early for children, and if they don't get the food that they need early on, they're not going to be prepared to be able to learn. So you can see the effect of malnutrition in terms of the size of children, but what you don't see is what's happening to their brain, and that really has a big impact on kids' ability to learn. And again, not being able to get through and get a decent education starts that whole cycle over again.
Carolyn Miles is president and CEO of Save the Children. From Fairfield, Connecticut, she spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua. Bubonic plague hits Madagascar every year around this time, but doctors say the current outbreak is especially worrying, given that it's in a remote location with no medical staff around to bring it under control. Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Even for Madagascar, this is no ordinary bubonic plague outbreak. The rat and flea-borne illness hits the island nation every year from about December to April. But Dr. Eric Bertrat of the World Health Organization says this latest outbreak has popped up in a new area. The mountainous Befotaka area in southeastern Madagascar has seen 68 cases and 27 deaths since the end of last year, according to WHO estimates. Bertrat said there are also unconfirmed reports of a nearby second cluster of some 30 cases. Speaking to VOA from Geneva after returning from a visit to Madagascar, Bertrat said the outbreak occurred in a place where there had been no plague cases since 1950.
And the specificity of this outbreak, this is not the disease by itself, but the fact that it occurred in a very remote and insecure place, where it's very difficult to go, and that's the main problem for the time being. There is no one to control the outbreak.
Bertrat says plague is impossible to entirely eradicate. To do so, he said, would mean killing every plague-carrying wild animal, which is an impossible task. Developed nations like the United States also experienced plague, with 16 reported cases in 2015, four of which ended in death. But Berthereit says Madagascar is exceptionally susceptible because of its persistent poverty. The spread of plague is aided by poor sanitation and a lack of health care. Berthereit says the disease is also spread in Madagascar as subsistence farmers continue to push into wild habitats.
Our hypothesis is that this reemergence, in fact, is due to first expansion of the natural focus with the migration of the rats, and also the fact that there are more and more contact between the local population and the forest area.
Plague can be quickly diagnosed and easily treated with common antibiotics. Health officials in Madagascar are urging residents to seek immediate care if they live in plague-endemic areas and begin to experience flu-like symptoms. Victims can also develop painful lymph node swelling and gangrene on their extremities. Without life-saving antibiotics, about two-thirds of those infected will die, according to the Centers for Disease Control. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. In Cameroon, a strike by English-speaking professionals has grown into a movement calling for greater autonomy, or even some say independence, for Anglophone parts of the country, while the government is having none of it. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports from Yaoundé.
Tensions continue to mount in Cameroon's English-speaking regions. A group of seven youths face a soldier in Ekona, a town in the southwest region, to acknowledge the existence of two banned groups, the Southern Cameroon National Council, or SCNC, and the more recently created Cameroon Anglophone Civil Society Consortium, or CACSC. Both groups have been banned by the government. The CACSC says its president, Bala Agbo, and its secretary general, Fontemneba, were arrested late Tuesday and taken to a police detention camp in Boya, the capital of the southwest region. The CACSC says hundreds of supporters of the group have also been arrested. Prior to their arrest Tuesday, Minister of Communication, Issa Chiruma, held a news conference. He said Cameroon will not tolerate threats to national unity.
The head of state has affirmed without any ambiguity that unitary form of the state is intangible and Cameroon is one and indivisible and shall so remain. There will therefore be no federalism, no secession.
English-speaking lawyers and teachers have been on a strike since October, protesting what they say is the overbearing use of French in public life. Cameroon is officially a bilingual country, but public documents are released only in French, and most officials speak little or no English, even in areas where English is the designated language. Among the union's original demands was for Cameroon to return to the system of federalism it abandoned in 1972. Those striking professionals have been joined by other groups, including the SCNC, which was founded in 1995 to seek full independence for the two English-speaking regions. The CACSC and SCNC say English speakers are treated as second-class citizens. The government accuses these groups of hijacking the ongoing strike to further their own political interests. Several demonstrations have degenerated into violence and talks to end the strike are at a standstill. The government has banned public meetings and earlier this month, authorities shut down a radio station in the northwest after it held an on-air debate on the strike. Organizers have responded with a ghost town strategy, calling on people in English-speaking parts of the country to simply stay home. They held another ghost town exercise this week, bringing commerce and transport in some areas to a grinding halt. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
The new United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres says he will take a positive, constructive approach in dealing with the new Trump administration on the many troubling issues facing the world today. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Antonio Guterres has assumed his post as Secretary General of the United Nations at a time when this world body has hit a particularly low point among certain political circles in the United States. But Guterres, a consummate politician and diplomat, brushes over recent negative comments and actions by vowing to engage constructively with the new American administration and find ways they can cooperate in a positive manner.
I would pick what President Trump said, that there is a lot of potential in the UN. That's exactly what I think, and that we need to work to reform the UN in order to make sure that that potential is fully met. There are obviously decisions of the Security Council in which the Secretary General has no influence.
Guterres is referring to a recent proposal by Republican Senators Lindsey Graham of South Carolina and Ted Cruz of Texas to cut off funds to the UN if the Security Council does not repeal a resolution it passed condemning Israeli settlements in the West Bank.
I will do my best to create the environment of dialogue and cooperation that will allow for all these problems to be effectively discussed. If possible.
Secretary General Guterres is open about the need to reform the United Nations. He says he is proud of the good work the UN has done over the past decades in humanitarian and peacekeeping actions. He acknowledges, though, what he calls the shortcomings and failures of the organization and vows to vigorously address them. He says his priority is to make the UN more effective in addressing the dramatic multiplication of global conflicts. He says he will work to move the UN away from being a reactive organization to one that works to prevent conflicts before they erupt. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
As Kenya's voter registration drive continues. Leaders are proposing creative ways to encourage people to sign up, including having electoral officials set up at weddings and funerals and even denying churchgoers the Holy Communion. From Nairobi, Jill Craig has more.
Kenya's electoral body says it is targeting about 9 million Kenyans over the age of 18 who have a national ID card or passport, but who have not yet registered to vote. Spiritual and political leaders, among others, are coming up with innovative ways to increase those numbers. Member of Parliament for Kilifi County, Gunga Muinga, recently proposed the Electoral Commission begin registering voters at weddings, palm wine ceremonies, local drinking establishments, even funerals.
Because these are places where people are, they go there in large numbers, and they should be able to register a good number of people if they take the machines there, instead of somebody sitting in a school where we'll only register like 3 or 5 people in a day.
An electoral official from Kenya's north coast says the commission supports the idea and will soon begin registering voters at social gatherings. Reverend Isaiah Njagi, an Anglican clergyman from Embu, has suggested non-registered voters be denied Holy Communion. He says Kenya's Christian population needs to do more than just pray for good leaders.
It is my personal view that people should be able to take voting as seriously as they take the doctrine of the church.
But High Court attorney and electoral expert Willis Otieno says these voter registration ideas are being conceived in political party strongholds, not battleground areas, in order to consolidate voting blocks.
It is not about the universal registration per se. It's about political camps bolstering their numbers, because you know very well that they know very well that once they register huge numbers in their strongholds, those huge numbers guarantee them votes in the general election.
Even so, Otieno argues high overall voter registration numbers will only help Kenya come August elections.
Look at what has happened in Gambia, for example, where part of the reasons why the outgoing president has been challenging those results is saying that a huge number of potential voters did not participate in the elections. Now, we don't want that kind of a scenario.
Personally, Otieno favors voter registration at social gatherings.
In fact, if it was my wedding, I would make a formal announcement to all the guests to please make sure they register as a present to wedding present to myself before they leave the wedding ceremony.
But Otieno acknowledges private business owners and event organizers cannot be forced to allow electoral officials on their property. After all, not everyone may want to combine their wedding registry with the voter registry. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanoff, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
I pledge to every citizen of our land that I will be president for all Americans.
On Friday, January 20th, all eyes will be on Washington, D.C. for the inauguration of Donald J. Trump as the 45th U.S. president. Be a part of history. Join VOA for 2 hours of special live coverage on radio and television, and on the internet at voanews.com. So tune in Friday, January 20th, starting at 1600 UTC, right here on VOA.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 1730 UTC, for lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today, because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this, whatever?
Employment rates are climbing.
So definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.